From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the first day of October 2019. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, traveling a bit today at the iHotel, hosting the Extension Administrative Professionals here. So we're now joined by Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana, to take a look at the settlement prices. Let's start first with corn. What did the December contract settle at today, Wayne?
$3.92.5. And that would be up 4.5 cents. So a nice move up today in the corn and closing basically just 0.25 cent off the high of the day. And that gets into that gap that we left a long time ago.
Yeah, so did we finish last month up with a key reversal? Is that right?
It sure looks like it, yes. And that's a very unusual thing for September. September is generally a down month. And remember, as we were talking last week on Commodity Week, we needed to, you know, have a good day on Monday and a good report to close higher for the month and do it. And we did it in strong fashion.
Yeah, we did it for both corn and soybeans. November beans settled how?
9.19.5, and that'd be up 13.5 on the day, Todd. The November beans are above their 200-day moving average and a 10-week high today, how they closed.
So why is it we have 2 days up in the beans in a relatively strong fashion?
Well, I think there's two or three things going out there. Number one, the crop report or the stocks report yesterday, they lowered the yield from last year a bushel, and that helps us take us down into some much lower carryout numbers that aren't quite as bad. I don't think the early beans are going quite as good as they're looking at as far as some of the early yields we're doing. And, you know, we're seeing China back in here buying a lot and very strong hopes that a Chinese deal could be cut.
And for corn, we had some follow-through today as well. Did that surprise you?
It was a little bit questionable whether it would or not. And we're still got some pretty strong resistance at $3.95 up to $4, up to $4.02 actually. But I think the beans help pull the corn on up. But a lot of people are looking here that they think the government's a little high and hoping that we'll see a little bit of a decrease in what they think the yields are going to be. You know, the government is 168 on the corn, and a lot of the groups really out here is looking that's out in the field talking to farmers and thinking a 162 is a little more realistic.
Is that the really next big thing, is the October WASDE report?
Oh, yes. By gosh, yes. It sure is. Because, the rest of this week, it's China's on holiday, so we're not going to get any news on the trade for that. And it's going to be just the next thing is looking to see what they say on that. And the actual yields out of the field, of course, are going to make quite a difference on how people are feeling. But I think the next big thing is the report.
And the harvest is lagging behind, according to yesterday's numbers.
Oh, yes. When you plant late, you harvest later. So very little corn in comparison to usual being done as of yet. And most everybody's talking 10 to 15 bushel less than most cases in last year on the corn, and that's why we're thinking that, closer to 160 is more realistic.
Hey, anything else before I let you go?
That's about it for today, Todd.
Hey, thanks so much. That is Wayne Nelson. He is with L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're now joined by Carl Zuloff. He's an agricultural economist from The Ohio State University and has penned an article for the Farm Doc Daily website, along with Krista Swanson, Gary Schnicki, Jonathan Kappas, and Nick Paulson from here on the University of Illinois campus. It's entitled Assessing Market Facilitation Payments in Hindsight and the Implications for Future Policy. I'm going to make a leap of faith here, Carl, and suggest that you've seen some things that were put into play before that have turned into actual agricultural policy. Can you tell me why you all decided to write this article?
Well, it's always, I think, an important part of both the policy process as well as the academic process to look back at what actually happened. The other part is looking forward and trying to figure out what's going to happen. But by looking backwards, you can come to an understanding of what actually happened and, assess was the impact exactly what people thought it was going to be. If we missed it, why might we have missed it? To lay the foundation for learning going forward.
So tell me about MFP1, and then maybe you can contrast that to MFP2 before we get into some more specifics.
Okay. MFP1 was instituted for the 2018 crop year for a total of 9 commodities: soybeans, cotton, sorghum, wheat, dairy, hogs, corn, fresh sweet cherries, and shelled almonds. The motivation for the MFP program in total, and that's continued through the version 2 for the 2019 crop year, has been to assist farmers and offset some of the negative impacts of the tariff war that has been going on now since the, I'm going to say, it's hard to date exactly, but let's say early 2018, with particularly China, but really a large number of other countries as well. So what the tariff war refers to is that the U.S. Instituted tariffs against a variety of countries, most notably China, for their trade practices. And they retaliated as they can under WTO. It's a perfectly legal retaliation by increasing tariffs on American commodities. Many of the most effective American commodities have been agricultural commodities, again, particularly to China. So the MFP program is designed to, in a sense, offset and compensate U.S. farmers for damages that they have incurred as part of a broader tariff war. There have been two programs. The MFP, what I call version 1.0, was the 2018 crop year for the 9 crops that I discussed a little bit earlier. That has expanded to 40-some crops in 2019. A broader array and a larger amount of payments.
And the expectation is that there will be an MFP 3.0 version because MFP 2 happened.
I think there's three factors that come together to lead to the expectation. Now, you're doing forecasting here, Todd, so you always have to realize you can easily be wrong. But I think there are three factors that come together that suggest that a 3.0 version would be at least a reasonable consideration is the term that I always use. The first is that there's an ongoing decline in U.S. farm exports in response to the tariff war. Economics is fairly straightforward in that you would expect exports to continue to struggle in an environment because people, other countries, particularly South America and the former Soviet Union countries in this case, have a chance to adjust their production over time, increase production in particular because because their demand has increased since our products have become more expensive due to the tariffs. That's the first thing. The second is that there's a very intense ongoing debate about the small refineries exemption from the ethanol mandate. And so these two start to interplay because they both affect demand. And then the third one is the 2020 presidential and congressional elections.
And then can you tell me a little bit about the fundamentals of supply and how they appear to be shifting into the next decade?
Well, the fundamentals of supply, what I would call, first of all, there is the trade adjustment that is going on because of the tariff war. And I think you always have to remember that. And that will continue as long as the tariff war should, the causative factors of the tariff war continue to exist, which is the imposition of tariffs. Obviously, this would change. I should mention, obviously, this would change if we were to sign a treaty, particularly with China, that would remove the tariffs. And so there's a presumption here in our discussion that a agreement with China, at least a total agreement for the removal of all tariffs, doesn't seem likely at the present time, although discussions are ongoing, and there will be significant discussions in the month of October among principal negotiators for both countries. So you need to keep that assumption in mind. But underneath that all, The farm prosperity period of 2007 to 2013 not only provided incentives for U.S. farmers to expand production, they provided incentives for other farmers to expand production around the world. In particular, the incentives were there for the South American producers, Brazil, Argentina, but it extends beyond them in South America, and the former Soviet Union countries of Ukraine, Russia, and Kazakhstan. In the 1970s, the big impact of that farm prosperity was an incentive for Brazil to expand production. In this time, I think it was a big incentive for the former Soviet Union countries to expand production. The other aspect that's going on is that there is a significant movement, still in its infant stages, but definitely growing towards moving toward electric vehicles. And that has a real strategic threat for U.S. agriculture because of ethanol production and biofuel production more broadly. The importance of this threat cannot be overstated. For the 2018 crop year, ethanol consumption accounted for almost 10% of all U.S. principal area crop plants. So it's not just a tariff war, Todd, that's going on right now. There are some fundamental strategic issues dealing with supply and demand that is also affecting this market at the present time.
Is it possible this will cause chronic surpluses in the United States?
I think to say that they will happen is an overstatement. To say that they would not happen is also an overstatement. I think, in the terminology that I like to use, is you cannot rule out a return to chronic surpluses in this situation. If these factors evolve in the way that I described previously, U.S. demand is likely to shrink, and that would require a shrinking of the sector in some way, shape, or form, either through the market or through government programs. We, of course, had significant chronic surpluses in the U.S. really all the way through from the 1930s until 1985. So really the last 20 years have been sort of an exception to a century-long trend towards chronic surpluses. So it is. I would not make the prediction that we would return to chronic surpluses, but I think farmers, agribusiness people, and others who deal with the farm sector need to put this on their radar screen, need to consider what it would mean for their industry, and at least to put it into their scenario process.
Carl Zuloff is an agricultural economist at The Ohio State University out of Columbus. We'll hear part two of this interview tomorrow, when we'll take up the policy implications, meaning what kinds of policies that Carl and the other agricultural economists that helped pin this article on the FarmDoc Daily website, farmdocdaily.illinois.edu, are thinking might come in the next Farm Bill. Just a quick hint, they're set-aside programs. You'll want to hear about that. We'll air that tomorrow during the closing market report. Right now, I want you to pick up the phone and dial this number, 217-244-9455. That's right, 217-244-9455. We're in the middle of our fall fund drive, and it's your turn to help support the agricultural programming that comes to you from Illinois Public Media. Now, I work really hard each and every day to try to bring you some good information in the closing market report and commodity week, but there's other agricultural programming throughout the day on Illinois Public Media that I'd like you to support as well, and you can find it all at willag.org. But if you change that just slightly and do willpledge.org or dial 217-244-9455, you can help us out financially. We're doing our level best to get you really good information all week long, every week of the year, with the brokers and the meteorologist and the agricultural economist and crop scientists that come from not only the University of Illinois, but other land-grant institutions across the Midwest. And if it makes a difference for you, right now is the time to show that. $120 is a great level to start with, but anything helps, anything works, less, more, it doesn't matter.
What does matter is that you give. Now, when you make the call, 217-244-9455, you can write a check. You can tell them you're going to send a donation later. You can use your credit cards. It just takes about 90 seconds, and it's really simple to do. But make sure you tell them it's in support of agriculture. They'll write that down. Or if you're online at willpledge.org, you put it in the comments section. In support of agriculture. Whatever you do, pick up the phone, go to the website, 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org, and make that donation now. And make sure you let them know it's in support of agriculture. Now, Don Day is here. He's with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Don, please tell me a little bit about the weather forecast.
Heading into this first week of October, Todd, we've got some really big contrast. A lot of folks have heard about the huge snows that fell in Montana, British Columbia, and Alberta over the weekend, up to 4 feet in some areas. Then we had record-breaking heat, and we still have record-breaking heat in the central and especially the southeastern parts of the United States. And as we go into the first few days of this new month, we're going to continue to see that contrast. Very cool and damp in the northern plains, the northwest, and the Rockies. Record-breaking heat for early October for the central and the southeast United States. But that colder air out west will spread east and south. We're going to see a ribbon of what could be a significant amount of rainfall cutting across portions of Iowa, Wisconsin, northern and western Illinois, northern Missouri, northeastern Kansas, and portions of eastern and central Nebraska. There could be as much as 3 to 5 inches of rain over the next 10 days in those areas as the boundary from that cold, moist air from the west hits that warmer air as it moves south. That's going to cause a lot of rain and thunderstorms. The Great Lakes, the rest of the Corn Belt, and the east will see cooler, more October-like air overspread late this week, over the weekend, and early next week, as finally some fall-like weather and an into the summer-like heat will be developing this weekend and next week across the central, the east, and the south.
Thanks, Don. Don Day is with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Joins us on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. Have you dialed in yet? Really? No? Why not? Hey, 217-244-9455. Dial your pledge of financial support for the agricultural programming that comes to you from Illinois Public Media, or you can go online at willpledge.org. Again, the number is 217-244-9455. Now, yesterday, the United States Department of Agriculture released the weekly crop progress reports. It shows as of Sunday that 88% of the corn crop around the nation had reached the dense stage. The normal is 98 on the 5-year average. 43% of the crop is mature. Normally that's 73%. And just 11% of the crop has been harvested. Normally at this time of the year, 19% has been harvested. Soybeans dropping leaves at 55%. The rolling 5-year average is 76%. And the harvested number there is 7%. Normally, it's 20%. Here are updates from the statisticians in Minnesota, Illinois, and Iowa.
This is Brad Medlock, agricultural statistician for the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service, Upper Midwest Regional Field Office. Iowa farmers experienced wet field condition as rain continued to fall throughout the state, limiting farmers to 3.3 days suitable for field work during the week ending September 29, 2019. Fieldwork activities included seeding cover crops, chopping silage, and harvesting hay, seed corn, soybeans, and corn for grain. Topsoil moisture condition was rated 0% very short, 4% short, 74% adequate, and 22% surplus. 90% of the corn crop has reached the dented stage or beyond, 17 days behind last year, nearly 2 weeks behind the 5-year average. 36% of the crop reached maturity, 18 days behind last year, and 2 weeks behind average. 2% of corn has been harvested for grain, 11 days behind average. Corn condition rated 65% good to excellent. 83% of the soybean crop has begun coloring or beyond, nearly 2 weeks behind last year and 9 days behind average. 49% of the crop has begun dropping leaves, 2 weeks behind last year and 9 days behind average. 3% of soybeans have been harvested, 8 days behind average. Soybean condition rated 63% good to excellent. For the USDA NAS Upper Midwest Regional Field Office, this is Brad Medlock.
This is Mark Schleusener, state statistician for Illinois with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Warm weather continued in Illinois last week, with temperatures ranging from 5 to 9 degrees above normal for this time of year. Significant rains came to central and northern parts of the state late in the week, with rainfall totals well above normal. Overall, the state averaged 2.2 inches of rain for the week, and that is 1.5 inches above normal. There was an average of 4.8 days suitable for field work last week, and topsoil moisture levels were reported as 8% very short, 14 short, 55 adequate, and 23% surplus, which is wetter than 1 week previous. Growing degree days accumulated since May 1 continued to be above average across all of Illinois. Corn has reached the dense stage on 85% of acres. That compares to 100% 1 year ago and 99% for the 5 year average. Only 40% of corn acres are rated as mature, well below the normal pace of 86. 4% of acres have been harvested compared to 30 normally. The condition of the Illinois corn crop was reported as 20% very poor to poor, 33% fair and 47% good to excellent, about the same as 1 week ago. The Illinois soybean crop is turning color on 77% of acres compared to 96% last year and 92% normally. 41% of soybean acres are dropping leaves compared to 76% normally, and 1% of acres are now harvested compared to 22% normally. The condition of the Illinois soybean crop was reported as 19% very poor to poor, 37% fair, and 44% good to excellent, nearly unchanged from last week. 4% of winter wheat has been planted for next year's harvest, compared to 7% 1 year ago and 6% normally. This has been Mark Schleusener with the Heartland Region Illinois Field Office of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is Dan Loftus, state statistician for the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, with weekly crop progress and condition report for the week ending September 29, 2019. Warm weather and somewhat dry conditions allowed for 3.9 days suitable for field work during the week. The warmer than normal temperatures across Minnesota aided crop development. Field activities for the week included harvesting, fall tillage, and terminating of cover crops. Small grain harvest is very near its completion. Topsoil moisture condition was rated 0% very short, 2% short, 63% adequate, and 35% surplus. Corn dented or beyond was 88%, that's 16 days behind last year and 2 weeks behind the 5 year average. 22% of corn was mature, that's 18 days behind last year and 2 weeks behind normal. Corn harvested for silage reached 43% this week, that's 13 days behind average. And the corn condition was rated 53% good to excellent, falling slightly from the previous week. 90% of the soybeans were turning color or beyond, that's 13 days behind last year and 8 days behind average. 60% of the soybeans have begun dropping leaves, that's 12 days behind last year and 8 days behind normal. 5% of the soybean crop had been harvested, that's 15 days behind last year and 11 days behind average. And the soybean condition was rated 56% good to excellent. Spring wheat harvested reached 97%, nearly 1 month behind last year and 11 days behind average. Pasture condition was rated 59% good to excellent, declining slightly from the previous week. For the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, this is Dan Loftus.
And I'm Todd Gleason. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this Tuesday afternoon. Do visit our website, willag.org, W-I-L-L-A-G.org. And don't forget to dial in your support at 217-244-9455 or online at willpledge.org.